walking toward the house from out in the fields, about where the man had been stooped over his labors a few mornings previously. Looking carefully, he saw that he was still there, still stooped over, still working. Emmy covered the ground with long, sure strides. Occasionally, she broke into a run, picking her way agilely over the loose dirt, and leaping over mounds and the carefully tended rows of vegetables. He stood and waved, and got no response, so he waited until she was closer before he raised his arm again. Still, she did not wave back. Seeming deliberately to avoid looking at him, she approached the gate. Once there, she jerked her head up, her face alive and expectantly tense. "Hello, Emmy."
"I saw the Oldsmobile. I thought..."
She didn't hide her disappointment. He felt embarrassed and unwanted.
"I'm sorry,"
he said quietly. She grasped the gate, which he had left open, and slammed it fiercely. With chin lowered, she pouted, her face swollen and defiant. Then she came up the walk, moving her legs reluctantly, and dropped on the step. Unnerved by her reaction, Ichiro fidgeted uneasily, thinking of something to say. At length, he too sat down beside her and remained silent. Without looking at her, he could sense that she was struggling to keep the tears from starting. There was a streak of brown dirt clinging across the toe of her shoe, and he restrained the urge to brush it off.
"It's just that I wanted so much for him to come back,"
she started speaking, almost in a whisper.
"It somehow seemed more important for him to come back this time than the other times he went down there. He's not coming back, is he?"
"No, I think not. He told me to tell you that he's thinking about you."
"I'm sorry,"
she blurted out.
"Sorry?" "I'm sorry I made you feel bad just now."
"You didn't."
"I did, and I'm sorry."
"Sure.
I'll make you something to eat,"
she said, and before he could refuse, rose and went into the house. In the kitchen, he watched as she moved from the refrigerator to the sink to the stove, fussing longer than necessary with each little thing that had to be done. He got the dishes and utensils from the cupboard and set them on the table. "Were you in love with him?" he asked. She turned and, apparently neither startled nor hurt, softly smiled.
"In a way. Not the way I love Ralph. Not the way I might love you. But I loved him. No. He's not gone yet. I love him too much, but not enough."
"Any other time I might not understand the way you put that, but I do."
"It doesn't matter. I'm glad if you do, but it really doesn't matter. Love is not something you save and hoard. You're born with it, and you spend it when you have to, and there's always more, because you're a woman, and there's always suffering and pain and gentleness and sadness to make it grow."
"He said he was thinking about you."
"You already said that. Besides, it doesn't need to be said."
She put the meat and potatoes in his plate and urged him to eat. For herself, she poured a cup of coffee and stirred it absentmindedly, without adding cream or sugar. Hungry as he thought himself to be, he found himself chewing lengthily on each little mouthful.
"And you?"
He looked at her, not quite understanding the intention of her words.
"What will you do now?"
"I haven't decided," he said honestly. "Strangely enough, I had a wonderful job offer in Portland, but I turned it down."
"Tell me about it."
He did so, dwelling at great length on his admiration for Mr. Carrick and the reasons for his final decision to refuse the job. Somehow, he had expected her to be impatient with what he had done,
but when he finished, she merely said, "It's good."
"That I turned down the job?"
"No. It's good that you found out things aren't as hopeless as you thought."
"Just like you said."
"I did say that, didn't I?"
She looked pleased.
"This Mr. Carrick you speak of sounds like the kind of American that Americans always profess themselves to be."
"One in a million," he added.
"Less than that,"
she said quickly.
"If a lot more people were like him, there wouldn't have been an evacuation."
"No. And one might even go farther and say, there might not have been a war."
"And no problems for you and me and everybody else."
"Nothing for God to do either," he said, without knowing why, and as soon as he knew that they had just been talking. What it amounted to was that there was a Mr. Carrick in Portland, which did not necessarily mean that there were others like him. The world was pretty much the same, except perhaps that Emmy and he were both sadder.
"Mr. Maina will give you work, if you wish. I was speaking to him about you just before you came."
Rising, he went to the stove to get the coffee pot, and did not answer until he sat down again.
"That would be nice, but I can't. Thanks anyway." "Why?"
"It won't do any good. It'll be like hiding. He's Japanese. Probably admires me for what I did, I suppose. Maybe it doesn't make any difference to him what I've done, but it does to me."
"What will you do then?"
"Find a girl that's not Japanese that'll marry me." Seeing the incredulous look on her face, he rapidly explained what Kenji had said to him.
"He didn't really mean it," she replied. "He only meant that things ought to be that way. But I think he knew he was only dreaming."
"He did. It's probably what makes him so unhappy and kind of brooding underneath."
"Is he really going to die?"
She looked at him pleadingly, as if beseeching him to say that it was not true. All he could do was nod his head. Emmy pushed her cup away abruptly, splashing some of the coffee onto the table. Then she cupped her face with her hands and began to sob, scarcely making a sound. "I have to go now," he said. "I may not come to see you again. And then, I might. I like you a lot already, and in time, I'll surely love you very deeply. That mustn't happen because Ralph will probably come back."
"He won't,"
she cried, without taking her hands away. "I think he will. Ken said he was writing to Ralph. He's got something in mind that'll jolt him hard enough to make him see what he's doing. He'll come back. Soon." He stood beside her a moment, wanting to comfort her. Slowly, he raised his arms, only to let them drop without touching her. Quickly, he brushed his lips against her head and ran out of the house. 8. Ichiro's father cradled the brown paper bag preciously in the soft crook of his arm and, with the other hand, pressed it firmly against his breast. In his hurry to get to the liquor store before it closed at 8 o'clock, he had left home without a coat or hat. Now, his legs moved quickly, sweeping him along the walk, which he felt hazily underneath him. It was still March and cool enough for a top coat. He shivered a little and felt fuzzy all over because it had been a while since the last drink, and that's how he felt when the effect of the liquor was beginning to wear off. It scared him to think that he might be sobering up. He ran, squeezing the bag tighter, when its contents began to jiggle. The bag would have made a snug fit for 4 bottles, but he had only bought 3, and that meant they were fairly loose. "Next time, I'll be sure to buy 4, he muttered to himself. "Yeah, 4 is best. The whole case better. Sanagabitch, I'm thirsty,"
Sound like a bitch. Cold, too. Plenty cold.
A block from the store, he attempted to leap over the curbing and didn't quite make it. Clutching the bag desperately, he managed to twist himself sufficiently in midair so that he hit the sidewalk with his shoulder. The impact cut his breath off momentarily and, as he lay gasping for air, he saw several people running toward him. When his breathing became regular, he ran his fingers over the bag, inspecting it for any wetness or jagged pieces of glass. Nothing seemed to be broken.
Okay,
he said in halting English to the inquiring faces above him.
Everything okay, just a fall.
He let the people help him to his feet and resumed his journey home. Not until he was at the door and had to shift the bag to reach for the key did he notice the soreness in his shoulder and back. Wincing a bit, he got himself inside and into the kitchen, where he left the bulb burning. With clumsy skill and haste, he tore the celluloid collar off one of the bottles and tilted it to his mouth. He had to grit his teeth and shake his head until the liquor settled inside of him. It was good. Horrible, but good. Craning his neck, he peered at the sore shoulder, and he could see where the fall had shredded his shirt and bruised the flesh. He poured some of the whiskey into his palm and rubbed it vigorously against the injury. It burned painfully, so much so that he had to take another big gulp from the bottle. Finally, he felt reasonably relaxed. Then he sat down and sadly regarded the untouched plate of food and the bowl of cold rice, which he had set out a few hours before. It was not the first time, nor the second. Mama had not eaten for 2 days, not since Ichiro had gone to Portland. He swigged at the bottle and forced himself to the bedroom door.
Mama!
And he said it plaintively.
Mama! Eat a little bit!
She was lying on the bed, silent and unmoving, and it made him afraid. It was not the thought of death, but the thought of madness which reduced him to a frightened child in the darkness. When she was not lying or sitting almost as if dead in her open-eyed immobility, she was doing crazy things. It had started with the cans, the lining of them on the shelves, hurling them on the floor, brooding, fussing, repacking them in the boxes, and then the whole thing over and over again, until hours after Ichiro had gone. Then silence, and he forgot now whether the silence was of her lying or sitting on the bed, the silence which was of the water quietly heating to boil. Following that silence had come the rain, the soft rain as always, drizzling and miserable and deceivingly cold, and he had not heard a sound, but when he had gone to the bedroom to see about throwing another blanket on her, she was out and back, hanging things on the line. How long she had been out in the rain, he couldn't say. Her hair was drenched and hanging straight down, reaching almost to the tiny hump of her buttocks, against which the wet cotton dress had adhered so that he could see the crease. He called her from the doorway, and was not disappointed when she hadn't heeded him, for that was how he knew it would be. So he had watched, until he could stand it no longer. And this time, he had run right up to her and shouted for her to stop the foolishness and come in out of the rain. And it still had done no good. He had come in then, and waited, and drunk some whiskey, and the bottle which had been half full was almost gone when the back door slammed. And then, once again, the awful silence. She was sitting that time. He remembered because when he went out to take the rain-soaked things off the line, he had to turn sideways to get past her. After that, he gazed sorrowfully at the bed on which his wife lay. It didn't matter what had happened after that. It only mattered what would happen now, or tonight, or tomorrow. Where and how would all this end? What was happening to her?
Mama, he wailed. Eat, or you will take sick.
Eat, or you will die.
As if in response to his voice, she stirred and rose and looked at him.
Ya, mama, eat.
She walked a few steps toward him hesitantly. Backing excitedly away from the door, he quickly made room for her to pass. Stopping short of the kitchen, she stood undecidedly for a moment, shaking her head slowly, as though to reshuffle her senses. Resolutely then, she leapt onto the floor of the bed and began to pull down the several suitcases which had been piled atop the cardboard wardrobe.
Mama!
It was an utterance filled with despair. He watched wretchedly as she pulled open drawers and proceeded to cram the cases full of whatever came into her grasping hands. How long this time, he thought, gently rubbing the ache in his shoulder with an unsteady hand, let himself drop heavily into a chair. He gripped the bottle with both hands, and his body shook tremulously. Biting his lip to imprison the swollen sob, which would release a torrent of anguish, he crumpled forward until he felt the coolness of the table spreading across his forehead. It helped to relax him. Suddenly, the scuffling and banging and scurrying in the bedroom stopped. Slowly, he looked up and, just as his gaze encompassed the door to the bedroom, he glimpsed her striding out and into the bathroom. She shut the door firmly behind her and, a moment later, he heard the bolt being slid into place. Then, the water sounded its way into the tub, not splashing or gurgling heavily, but merely trickling, almost reluctantly so, it seemed. He gulped from the bottle and listened to the trickling of the water against the bottom of the white tub, as it slowly changed into a gentle splashing of water against water as the tub began to fill. Why doesn't she turn the faucets on full? He thought impatiently. Turn it on like you always do. Be quick and efficient and impatient, which is the way you have always been. Start the water in the tub and scrub the kitchen floor while it is filling up. When the floor is done and the mop wrung out and hung back to dry, the water is good, just the right depth. Like a clock you are, not a second wasted. He gulped again, and the progress of the water was so painfully slow that he could hardly discern any change in the pattern of its splashing. At length, irritated, he retreated into the store, holding the bottle in one hand and groping his way through the darkness, almost to the front door, where the sounds from the bathroom couldn't reach him. Upending an apple box which contained a few discolored Jonathans, he sat himself down as the apples tumbled across the floor. Straightening up to tilt the bottle to his mouth, he was suddenly overcome by the worry and strain of the past several days.
Tired. So very much tired.
He groaned aloud as he doubled over his knees and set the whiskey on the floor. Remaining thus, stretching the pain in his bruised shoulder so that it felt like a row of needles clawing into the heaviness which weighted him down, he bemoaned his fate. Kinchan, that is what your sister calls you now. Now that life has become too hard for her to bear, she once again calls you Kinchan. For then she thinks of the days when we were all young and strong and brave and crazy. Not crazy like today or yesterday, but crazy in the nice, happy way of young people. No, not crazy like you, old woman. Once, I too called you Kinchan. 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 You were good then. Small and proud and firm and maybe a little bit huffy, but good and soft inside. Yeah, yeah. I was smart too. I found out how good and soft before we married. Right under their eyes, almost. Your papa was there, and you beside him, and your mama was already dead. Then there was myself, and my mama and papa, and the man who was the village mayor's brother, whose name I forget, but who was making the match. How he could talk, that man. Talk and drink and talk, talk, talk. But he was only talking then because it was time for business, and he was talking about how fine a wife you would make for the son of my father and mother. And your head was down low, but I could see you smiling. How sweet it was then. How wonderful. Then he was talking about me, and I sat up straight and full and puffed my chest, and I could see you stealing a look once or twice, and you were pleased. I was pleased too. Everybody was pleased, and the thing was settled quickly, for that time was only for making the matter final. And when one is feeling gay and full of joy, the sake must be brought out to lift the spirits higher. And they drank, your papa and mine, and the mayor's brother, and I only a little, because I was even happier than they and needed no false joy. Then the moment was at hand when Mama was telling Papa not to drink so much, and you were in the kitchen heating more sake, and your Papa and that man were singing songs not to be heard by such as you. It was to the toilet I was going when you saw me, and I, you. There was nothing to be said. It was not a time for words, but only deep feeling. And there, in the darkness of the narrow corridor between the house and the smelly toilet, I made you my wife, standing up. It was wonderful. More wonderful, I think, than even the night of the day when we really were married. Do you know it was never that good for me again? Yeah, Kinchan. That was the mistake. We should have waited, and then everything would have been proper. We were not proper, and so we suffer. Your papa, my mama, and that man did not know. But the gods knew. It was dark, and we were standing. But they were watching and nodding their heads and saying, shame, black shame. Ugh, he moaned. Then, peering into the darkness, he called softly,
Taro, Ichiro.
There was no answer. Only the darkness and the little bit of light that slanted into the other end under the curtains that blocked off the kitchen. He leaned forward intently, smiling pleasantly as if the boys were in front of him. He knew they were not there, but the desire to voice their names could not be resisted. And so again he called,
Taro, Ichiro,
as if to catch their eager responses. He cocked his head, playing the game for all the pleasure that he could derive from it in momentary escape from the soul-crippling truth. There was a gurgle, faint and muffled. Curious, he listened. The gurgling continued for a while longer and ceased the moment he realized it was the bathwater. And abruptly, the present was crammed back into his tired being. Snatching the bottle off the floor with a swoop of his arm, he reared back against the staggering weight of his depression and poured the whiskey into his gaping mouth. All, he resolved silently to himself, I will drink all like the man that I am. Holding his breath so as not to taste the cheap liquor, he gulped greedily. He endeavored stubbornly, his stomach now extended to the point of bursting and his mouth jerking in labored gasps as his whole being clawed for air. Then he became frightened and wanted to stop, but the dizziness set in, and all he could think was that his mouth was off at a distance by itself and mechanically jawing like a spasmodic reflex. Soon his mouth was filled to overflowing. His fingers no longer seemed to respond to his will, and he instinctively averted his face as he sensed the bottle slipping free. Spewing whiskey out of his mouth with a noisy roar, he toppled off the box and onto the floor, where he lay, utterly exhausted. Dimly, he heard a car scraping its tires against the curb beyond the thin outer wall. The illumination from its headlights filtered into the store, and he found himself trying to focus upon the Lucky Strike poster, which was stapled above the shelves of canned goods. The colors kept running together, and the big red circle he knew was there refused to stay still or single. It kept doubling and tripling and constantly distorting itself into fuzzy-edged, lopsided circles. Sick and tired and drunk, he closed his eyes and listened to the steady purr of the idling motor, and quickly succumbed to sleep. Outside in the car, Ichiro sat undecided. He felt very much alone. He knew he would not see Kenji or Emmy again. They had been good to him. Kenji and Emmy and Mr. Carrick. Three people who had given a little of themselves to him because they liked him. It had not mattered to any of them about the thing that he had done. True, he was alone again. But not quite as nakedly alone as he had been the first day out of prison and walking up Jackson Street on the way home. The motor still idling, he squinted a bit and peered into the store. Cracks of light were visible far inside. They were home, of course. Where could they go? He wondered how his mother was doing, and he thought distastefully about the business of the cans. Where the headlights sprayed into the store, he saw the red top of the Coca-Cola freezer and, beyond it, the wall full of canned goods. He looked at the Lucky Strike sign and felt somewhat bothered when he couldn't quite make out what he knew were the words, "It's toasted." Settling back against the seat, he peered in the opposite direction at the clock tower of the depot, under which Edo had made him crawl. It was still only a few minutes after 9. Making up his mind impulsively, he pressed the accelerator pedal and, without another glance at home, drove to Kenji's house. When he rang the bell at the top of the steep hill, the father came to the door. "Hello, Mr. Kano," he said, recognizing the man who seemed not to have changed a great deal in appearance since he had last seen him years ago in the camp in Idaho. "I brought the car back," he said.
"The car?"
"Yes, Ken's car. I went to Portland with him."
"Come in," the man said earnestly. "Please, come in."
"No, I should get on home." He held out the keys.
"Just for a minute, please."
Kenji's father motioned him inside. He stepped into the house and watched as the big man strode across the living room and turned off the television set. Then Mr. Kano came back to where he stood waiting and regarded him thoughtfully.
"I seem to recall your face, but..."
"I'm Ichiro Yamada. I guess I've changed."
"Of course, I remember. How's your family?"
"Fine, sir."
"Sit down. I'm all alone tonight. Been watching the ball game."
"I'm sorry I interrupted."
"Doesn't matter. Seattle's got a rotten team this year."
He pulled his chair closer to Ichiro, and it was apparent that his mind was not on baseball. "The keys," said Ichiro, and placed them in the other's palm.
"Thank you."
It was quiet in the house, quiet and warm and comfortable.
"Would you care for a drink?"
"No."
"When did you see him?"
"This morning."
"How was he?"
"Seemed pretty fair." He knew he should have remained still, but he found himself clumsily shifting on the sofa. Mr. Kano waited until he had settled down once more before saying,
"Still alert, was he? Able to talk and see and feel?"
Alarmed, he suddenly began to ramble with too much fervor. "Of course, he's fine. He was in excellent spirits when I left him this morning. A week, 10 days, before you know it, he'll..." And he stopped, as suddenly upon seeing the look in his father's eyes which said, "My son and I had no secrets, and if death is a truth about which you wish not to speak to me, do not speak at all."
"You mean well,
but this is not the time for kindness, said the father gently. I'm sorry.
We're all sorry. Now, tell me.
We drove down two nights ago and, on the way, got a ticket for speeding in some hick town. I was driving, but Ken switched places with me because he knew I didn't have a driver's license. The cop tried to make us pay off, but Ken said no and got a ticket, which he tore up. Then, just before he went into the hospital, he said something about the cop having to come a long ways to get him. He was implying that he was going to die and...
Yes, that sounds like him.
The father looked pleased. In the hospital, I just saw him the one time this morning. He knows he's going to die. He said as much. He looked bad, physically that is, and he sounded a little bitter. I wish he were wrong, but I don't think there's any doubt. It's a matter of time, I guess.
But his mind, it was all right. He talked sensibly.
Yes. He seemed a little weak, but otherwise he was just as usual.
Good. If he had to go, I wanted it to be quick, and so it has been.
Not grasping what the father meant, Ichiro regarded the man questioningly.
Ken is dead. 3 o'clock this afternoon.
At 3 o'clock, he had been in a roadside cafe, eating pie and drinking coffee, while Kenji's Oldsmobile was being gassed up. There were no words to describe the numbness of feeling in himself, and he made no attempt to seek them.
Let me drive you home now, before the others start returning, said the father softly. I did not tell them at dinner, because they had planned to see a movie tonight, and I could see no reason for denying them the fulfillment of the day's pleasures. Tomorrow, I will go to Portland and make arrangements for the funeral.
You will be bringing him back here?
No. We were talking once, Ken and I. One of the several times when we talked about his dying.
He shut the door without locking it, and they walked slowly to the car.
Don't bother about me when I die, Pop, he said. No fuss, no big funeral. If I'm in Portland when it happens, let them take care of it. Let them dig the hole. And then he said, I'll come back and haunt you if you stick me in Washeli with the rest of the Japs. I've got ideas about the next place, and I want to get started right.
Starting the car, the man swung the Oldsmobile in a tight semicircle and eased down the hill.
I thought it was pretty nice when the community got together and secured permission to bury the dead in Washeli. For a long time, it was only for white people, you know. True, they keep the Japanese dead off in a section by themselves. But still, I thought it was pretty nice. Ken, well, he was upset. Put my ashes in an orange crate and dump them in the Sound off Connecticut Street dock where the sewer runs out, he used to say. He knew I wouldn't do that, but I'll see he's not put in Washeli. We'll have a small service, just the family, and maybe they'll find a place for him down there where he'll be happy.
Ichiro listened to the quiet voice of the father and, when he turned to say something, he saw the glistening of the tears on the sorrow-stricken face. Turning away, he replied, he deserved to live.
And to be happy, added the father. He was a good boy, pleasant, thoughtful, well-liked, but never really happy. The others, they seemed not to mind so much. They say to themselves, This is the way things are, and they are quite happy. He was not that way. He was always asking why things had to be the way they were. For him, I often think I should have never come to America. For him, I think I should have stayed in Japan, where he would have been a Japanese, with only other Japanese. And then, maybe, he would not now be dead. It is too late now for such thoughts. They did not speak again until the car was beside the grocery store. It was Ken's father who said,
"Thank you for all you've done for us."
"I did nothing. Ken did much for me. I can't tell you how sorry I am."
"The family must know," said the man. "I must go home and tell them that Ken is dead. It will be very difficult."
"Yes."
"Goodbye, Ichiro."
He waved in return and watched until the car turned out of sight at the end of the block. Finding the door unlocked, he entered the store and stood for a moment in the dark. He wondered at the complete stillness and frowned slightly at the stench of whiskey. Slowly, he started toward the living quarters of the building. His foot struck a bottle and, when he peered over the floor to locate it, he noticed the several winding rivulets of water working their way across the boards and making shallow pools in the low spots. Perplexed, he traced the water into the kitchen, and there, underneath the bathroom door, the flow was wide and strong and steady. His hand already reaching for the doorknob, he suddenly felt the necessity of looking into the bedroom. He did so, seeing the pile of suitcases stacked neatly on his parents' bed, but no sign of his mother or father. Frightened now, sensing the tragedy inherent in the stillness, he rushed to the bathroom door and found it locked. Angrily, he drove his shoulder repeatedly against the door, feeling it give grudgingly a tiny bit each time, until the final assault threw him into the bathroom. She was half out of the tub and half in, her hair of dirty gray and white floating up to the surface of the water like a tangled mass of seaweed and obscuring her neck and face. On one side, the hair had pulled away and lodged against the overflow drain, damming up the outlet and causing the flooding, just as her mind, long shut off from reality, had sought and found its erratic release. Feeling only disgust and irritation, Ichiro forced his hand into the tub to shut off the flow of water. He looked at her again and felt a mild shiver working up his back and into his shoulders. Momentarily unnerved, he found himself thinking frantically that she ought to be pulled out of the water. With movements made awkward by an odd sense of numbness, he bent over to grasp her about the waist. At the touch of her body against his hands, it occurred to him that all he need do was pull the plug. Calm now, he reached for the chain and pulled it out and over the side. He watched for a while as the water level fell, drawing her tangled hair with it until the sickly white of her neck stood revealed. "Dead," he thought to himself. "All dead. For me, you have been dead a long time, as long as I can remember. You who gave life to me and to Taro, and tried to make us conform to a mold which never existed for us, because we never knew of it, were never alive to us in the way that other sons and daughters know and feel and see their parents. But you made so many mistakes. It was a mistake to have ever left Japan. It was a mistake to leave Japan and to come to America and to have two sons, and it was a mistake to think that you could keep us completely Japanese in a country such as America. With me, you almost succeeded, or so it seemed. Sometimes I think it would have been better had you fully succeeded. You would have been happy, and so might I have known a sense of completeness. But the mistakes you made were numerous enough and big enough, so that they, in turn,
made inevitable my mistake. I have had much time to feel sorry for myself. Suddenly, I feel sorry for you. Not sorry that you are dead, but sorry for the happiness you have not known. So, now you are free. Go back quickly. Go to the Japan that you so long remembered and loved, and be happy. It is only right. If it is only after you've gone that I am able to feel these things, it is because that is the way things are. Too late, I see your unhappiness, which enables me to understand a little and, perhaps, even to love you a little. But it could not be otherwise. Had you lived another 10 years or even 20, it would still have been too late. If anything, my hatred for you would have grown. You are dead, and I feel a little peace. And I want very much for you to know the happiness that you tried so hard to give me. Stooping over, he lifted her easily and carried her to the bedroom, where he laid her beside the pile of suitcases. Lingering a while longer, he brushed the damp hair away from her face and pushed it carefully behind her head. Then he made his way through the kitchen and into the store behind the counter to the telephone. He wasn't quite sure whom he intended to call, but he realized that there were people to be informed. He thought of the Kumasakas and the Ishidas, and he recalled having heard mention of a young Japanese whom he had known slightly at one time, and who now was a mortician, cashing in on the old Japanese who were dropping off like flies. He tried to think of the fellow's name, and could only vaguely remember what the fellow looked like years ago in a faded pair of wide-ribbed corduroy trousers that stopped about 3 inches above ugly thin ankles. Then he thought of the coroner and decided that he was the one to call. Having to look up the number, he reached overhead and turned on the light. He blinked his eyes at the sudden illumination and, as he did so, sighted the whiskey bottle on the floor over against the vegetable stand where he had kicked it. Wondering why the bottle had been so carelessly placed, he glanced about the store and saw the overturned apple box and, alongside of it, his father's stockinged feet. Hurrying out from behind the counter, he examined the prostrate figure on the floor. "Pa!" he shouted with alarm. The father lay on his back, with his face turned sideways, and a thin streak of spittle oozed out of the corner of his partly open mouth. He was asleep and snoring softly. Grabbing the old man by the shoulders, Ichiro shook him vigorously. He stopped when he saw the eyes open lazily and regard him with drunken indifference. The mouth curved into a silly grin and, immediately, the eyes shut and the heavy breathing was resumed. Furiously, he shook him again, pulling as he did so and bringing the body to a sitting position. The eyes opened once more, and the mouth emitted several unintelligible grunts of protest. "Pa, are you all right?" he shouted. His father grinned and shook his head. "Ma is dead. You hear me? Dead. Killed herself. Ma killed herself." He continued to grin, giving no sign of understanding. "Sick," he mouthed thickly. "Mama sick. Papa sick. Ichiro good boy. Everybody sick." "God damn you, Pa. I'm telling you, Ma's dead."
"Tell Taro he should come home. Mama needs him."
With that, he shut his eyes and let himself collapse. Ichiro hung on for a moment, and then let him drop. Angrily, he returned to the telephone and leafed through the book in search of the coroner's number. 9. The funeral was held several days later at the Buddhist church up on the hill next to a playground. Ichiro sat uncomfortably in a small waiting room and listened impatiently to the talking of the men gathered around the table in the center of the room. His father sat with the men and, while appearing ill at ease in a navy blue suit, obviously new and purchased for the occasion, seemed nonetheless to be enjoying himself. When he spoke, he did so eagerly, striving to maintain an air of solemnity, but too often unable to suppress a pleased grin.
"Yeah, yeah, a good wife," he was saying. "But she is gone, and we talk no more about her. There is no use for tears."
His protestations went unheeded, for they were gathered to attend a funeral, and one was expected to say the right things.
"How many years, Yamada-san?"
questioned respectfully a tall, thin individual who, playing his part to the full, had not smiled at all.
28 years, Noji-san, replied the father. "Such a long time. My wife and I have been together 32 years, but 28 years is also a long time. How lonely you must be."
Mr. Noji sniffed loudly and poked at his eye with a soiled handkerchief.
"It is very sad indeed,"
added Mr. Ishida, who sat by the window in a crumpled gray suit.
"But she has given you two fine boys. Two fine boys indeed."
Everyone turned and looked for a moment at Ichiro, who sat alone on a sofa against the wall. He squirmed uneasily and wondered if Taro would acknowledge the telegram which he had sent the day before, after finally having hunted down the information that he was taking basic training in a California camp. When it finally came time to fill out the yellow form, all he had been able to write was, "Ma dead, suicide." Was there something more he should have written?
"Almost time,"
said Mr. Kumasaka softly. As a close friend of the family, he was graciously handling all the details of the funeral. Several of the men took out pocket watches or regarded their wrists and mumbled and nodded.
"Has everything been seen to?"
queried a large man, whose name Ichiro could not remember.
"I believe so,"
answered Mr. Kumasaka, whose thoughtful look indicated that he was hurriedly running a mental check.
"The telegrams. You have someone to read the telegrams?"
The large man, having suddenly recalled that no mention had been made of telegrams, was quite excited. Mr. Kumasaka tried staring him down.
"Ah, I felt something had been overlooked. There is so much to do, so many details."
Equal to the occasion, the large man rose to his feet and beckoned to Mr. Ishida.
"Please, Ishida-san, be so kind as to find someone, one of the younger people who are here. There is little time. Hurry."
Mr. Ishida started hastily out of the room, but got no farther than Mr. Kumasaka, who had stretched out a restraining arm.
"There is no need, Ishida-san. There are no telegrams."
He looked up at the large man and repeated with a softness which was weighted with disapproval,
"There are no telegrams."
Flustered, the man dropped back into his chair.
"Of course, of course. I was only trying to be of assistance."
"It is just as well," said the tall, thin one. "They are always the same. Someone reads telegrams at all the funerals, and I do not understand them, but I know they are the same. You pick them from a card at the telegraph office. I know, because I have sent them. They have cards for any occasion. Funerals, weddings, holidays. I have sent them myself. You go to the telegraph office and say I want to send a funeral wire, and the woman gives you a card, and there are maybe 10 different ones on it, and you simply pick the one you want. If it is a good friend, you pick the longest. If not so good a friend, you pick one of the shorter ones. Years ago, when my cousin's youngest boy was killed by a train in Oregon, I went to the telegraph office and...
It is time, gentlemen. Please.
The church attendant addressed them from the doorway. The men filed out solemnly down the hall after the attendant. The father and Ichiro walked a few steps in the opposite direction and entered the auditorium from a side door, which led them directly to the first row of seats, which had been reserved for them. As they took their places and glumly regarded the open casket only a few feet away, the priest sauntered across the stage with its lavish gold-bedecked shrine and seated himself beside an urn-like gong. Without acknowledging the people present, he struck the gong several times and promptly proceeded to recite the unintelligible mumbo-jumbo revered by all the old ones present, but understood by none. The air was heavy with the smell of incense and, behind him, Ichiro could hear the fervent muttering of sacred words, the occasional sucking of breaths, and a distant sob or two. Sitting up straight, he could see the profile of her heavily powdered, cold, stony face protruding above the rim of the casket. It was a nice casket, but he still couldn't understand why his father had insisted on the $400 light blue one when the $250 gray one would have sufficed. He hadn't argued. The old man seemed to know what had to be done. He felt his father turn slightly toward him, and he met his gaze. The round face oozed with insuppressible excitement. It had been that way ever since the news of the mother's death had gotten around, and the few close and many distant friends had crowded into the tiny store to offer assistance and condolences, and to sit around and talk and drink tea and eat cookies and cake. Many were strangers whom he had no recollection of ever having met, and yet they had filled the store during all hours of the day and night until this very evening. In the midst of it all, his father had been flushed without touching a drop, drunk with the renewal of countless friendships, and elated by the endless offerings of sympathetic phrases. Women were constantly hovering over the stove, cooking meals for the bereaved in the morning, scrubbing the floor, and making the beds and keeping the children quiet, while the men ate and drank and smoked and talked endlessly. It had been quite a show, and this was the final scene. If it all added up to something, he had missed it. He wanted very much for all of it to come to an end. And now, his father said excitedly to him,
"Plenty people, Ichiro. A good funeral for Mama."
He felt the disgust creep into his face, but the father had already turned away and was again sitting with his head slightly bowed and shoulders softly slouched, so that he must have presented a grief-filled figure to his audience behind him. Bringing his chant to a close with a series of well-timed blows on the gong, the priest rose and faced the mourning flock. He bowed to the widower and his son, and ran a rosary-draped hand contemplatively along the front of his black robe, with the wide, gold-embroidered collar. His shiny bald head bulged at the temples, the pink skin stretched tight as if ready to burst. Small black eyes peered out of the round, massive face that might have been frightening had one unexpectedly confronted it, but which radiated only understanding and generosity to those who viewed it and knew that it was the countenance of their good priest. His voice was pitched too high, and attempting now to speak as one mourner to another, had lost the resonance and rhythm with which the holy chanting had been done. What he did, virtually, was to announce the funeral, giving the names of the deceased and the immediate members of the family, and then, gazing sympathetically upon the grieving father and son, he offered them words of courage. Ichiro squirmed, looking neither left nor right and feeling the presence of his father beside him, like a towering mass of granite. After the priest, there were others who spoke. Embarrassed old gentlemen in ill-fitting Sunday suits who had been requested to speak of the deceased. They were like grade school orators with badly prepared speeches, agonizing the audience with futile gestures and excruciating pauses, and hopefully offering shaky grins, which merely heightened the general discomfort. They said fine things about the dead woman in fine language, which none ordinarily used, but heard more frequently only because the number of funerals seemed to be increasing. And it was the large man who had caused the blunder about the telegram who gave, in a fairly shouting voice, the biography of the deceased. As he shouted, Ichiro listened and, it was as if he were hearing about a stranger, as the man spoke of the girl baby, born in the 31st year of the Meiji era, to a peasant family, of her growing and playing and going to school and receiving honors for scholastic excellence, and of her becoming a pretty young thing who forsook a teaching career to marry a bright, ambitious young man of the same village. And as the large man transported the young couple across the vast ocean to the fortune awaiting them in America, Ichiro no longer listened, for he was seeing the face of his dead mother jutting out of the casket, and he could not believe that she had ever been any of the things the man was saying about her. Then he looked at his father, who was hungrily devouring each meaningless word of praise, and was so filled by now with the importance of himself that he held his head high and smiled pleasantly for all to see. First, he felt sick and wanted to get out of there. Then, he had an urge to laugh. So funny the whole affair seemed, and he made himself turn back to look at his mother's face to sober himself. And he kept looking at her until the service was over, and the men from the mortuary in tails and striped trousers came up to close the casket. They wheeled it slowly down the center aisle to the long black Cadillac hearse waiting at the curb. He got into the limousine behind the hearse with his father and waited for other people to get into their cars. A uniformed patrolman waited alongside his motorcycle, impatient to get the caravan to its destination and earn his extra pay. "Pa, I feel sick," he said.
"Yeah, Ichiro, but pretty soon. Not much more now."
He was looking out of the window and acknowledging the bows of passing people.
"What's next? I've had enough."
"Not much. We go to the funeral parlor, then a short service by the priest, put the casket in the oven, and then to eat."
"Eat?"
"Yes, it is custom. We feed the people who were so kind as to come. It will be at the Japanese restaurant, since home is too small. Everything is arranged."
"For Christ's sake," he moaned.
And at that instant, he spied the face of Freddy hastening behind the limousine and cutting diagonally across the street to a parked car. He watched, seeing the little coupe billow forth a cloud of smoke, then begin to maneuver its way out of a tight spot. He jumped out of the limousine and raced across the street. Freddy was just getting ready to pull out into the street when he reached the car and jumped in.
"What the hell?"
swore Freddy and, as quickly, was purposefully brandishing a huge pipe wrench.
"It's me. Take it easy." He thrust his face closer.
Freddy blinked in amazement and repeated softly,
"What the hell?"
"Move. Come on,"
urged Ichiro.
"Sure."
He shot the car down the street and sped away from the church and the people and the funeral. "I shouldn't do this," he thought to himself. "I ought to go and see the thing through properly. I owe her that much. In a way, she did a lot for me, a lot more than most mothers. Looking at it from her side, it was a hell of a lot. She meant well. She was all wrong, all crazy and unfeeling and stubborn. But she thought she was doing right. It wasn't her fault that things didn't go right. It wasn't she who wished the war on all of us and got the Japs thrown off the coast and stirred up such a mixed-up kind of hatred that no one could think or feel straight. No. In her way, she was right, and I'm still wrong. But I mustn't admit it. I want to stay here and find a place where I can work and eat and laugh a little sometimes. Is that asking too much? I am right. She made me do wrong, but I am right in knowing what must be done. I will find work somehow, somewhere, and I will eventually learn to laugh a little because I shall want to laugh for feeling good all over. Time. How slowly it passes. I will hope and wait and hope and wait, and there will come a time. It must be so. She is dead. Time has swept her away, and time will bury my mistake. She is dead, and I am not sorry. I feel a little bit freer, a bit more hopeful. The car swerved hard, squealing around the corner and jarring him away from his thoughts.
God damn! Swore Freddy. Didn't see that red light.
He gripped the steering wheel with both hands and drove recklessly with an almost frightened determination.
What's the hurry?
He said, alarmed.
You asking?
He kept his eyes straight ahead.
Yes. For Christ's sake, he's asking.
Well?
You told me. Take off, you said.
You can slow down now. I didn't mean it that way. Braking the car hard and suddenly, he threw it to a stop against the curb.
Make up your mind, for Christ's sake. You can do better, you drive.
He fumbled for a cigarette underneath his coat and, poking it into his mouth, jabbed at the lighter. He waited nervously, pulling up the lighter too soon and sucking uselessly on the cigarette. He tried to get it back into the hole, but his hand was trembling too much. Ichiro took the lighter from Freddy and, after replacing it, struck a match for him. What's eating you? He remembered how quickly the wrench had been in Freddy's hand.
Nothing. You got me nervous, that's all.
Why?
Why? Take off, you said. I took off, didn't I?
I thought you were going to slug me with that wrench.
It was a mistake.
What's got you so scared?
Nothing, damn it. I ain't scared of nothing.
As he gestured with his hand, he knocked the head off the cigarette. For a minute, he pawed furiously at the glowing embers on his coat. Then he was sucking busily on the stub, which wouldn't rekindle. He crushed it between his fingers and threw it against the dash.
Jesus,
he moaned.
Don't ever do it again.
What's that?
Scare me like that. God damn it, don't ever do it again or I'll shove a knife right between your balls.
Heaving a long, drawn-out sigh, he slumped down and let his head rest on the steering wheel. Thanks for coming to the funeral, Ichiro said.
Sure.
Want me to drive you home?
No, I'm okay.
Who did you think I was?
One of them guys.
What guys?
I'm sorry about your mom. It's tough.
Better this way?
Sure. Still tough anyway.
Lighting a cigarette, he tapped Freddy on the shoulder and put it in his mouth. Freddy sat up, no longer trembling. Who's after you?
Some guys.
What for?
I cut him.
Who?
Ato. Oh.
Freddy started to laugh, then said defiantly,
He asked for it. He come up to the bar and started digging at me. I told him to beat it. He wouldn't go. He kept needling me. The guys were laughing.
Everybody? He had to know.
No. Some of them were telling him to lay off. He wouldn't. Then he said shit like me wasn't good enough to spit on. I told him to try it. He did, but he was drunk. The stuff just dribbled down his chin. God, I hate the bastard.
So you used your knife?
I said I would. I was mad.
Bad? Freddy laughed.
In the ass. When I went for him, some guy behind him pulled him off the stool. It swung him around and I got him in the ass.
And then?